Again, the Israeli intelligence establishment and the U.S. intelligence establishment in the 1980s were closely coordinating their counterterrorism policies. In this particular section, Ari Ben Menashe is focusing only on the Mossad connection. We're going to be talking about concerns, active U.S. complicity with the same type of activity. And again, in Radio Free America 38, what we're going to be looking at is the strategic use of terrorism and counterterrorism, and ultimately what we're going to be looking at is the growth of the counter-terrorist apparatus to completely subvert the democratic process in this country and ultimately, perhaps, to do away with it altogether. I want to reiterate something that I have cited many times in the past. When the U.S. national security establishment decides to move in any given direction, they only decide to move in that direction when to do so would scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. The terrorist incidents obviously serve to discredit the people that they are blamed on. They also serve, as I've said, as a pretext for an aggressive military posture abroad and for reduced civil liberties and a greater and more police state tactics here at home to deal with the terrorist threat. Ultimately, we're going to be seeing how counterterrorism has been used to set up a national security structure which completely bypasses the normal machinery of government and which ultimately could, as I said, completely bypass the democratic process altogether in the United States. We're going to be taking a musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to be visiting with Farah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance living here in the United States, and along with his colleagues in the Iranian resistance, the resistance against the Islamic fundamentalist government currently in power in Iran. The research developed by Mansour and his colleagues would indicate that the October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the United States Embassy there in November of 79 until Carter's election, his humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured, that the October surprise, as well as the arms transfers conducted under the Iran-Contra scandal, were themselves outgrowths of a long-standing policy of collaboration between elements of U.S. intelligence controlling elements and the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Iran and elsewhere. That, in fact, the Iran-Contra scandal and the October surprise were only manifestations, and relatively minor ones at that, of a much broader-based and longer-running policy. Last week I read a circular letter that was sent out by Farah Mansour and his colleagues in the Iranian resistance. We are going to be visiting with Farah Mansour, and we will be recapping information from that circular letter and talking about other things as well. And tonight's segment, this particular segment, I should say, of Radio Free America 38, is going to go into the archives, not only as part of Radio Free America 38, but as an addendum to Radio Free America program number 31, dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal, the terror connection part 2, the destabilization of the Carter administration, music, and then an interview with Farah Mansour. We are back now, and we are proceeding with the prepared portion of Radio Free America of tonight's program. This is another installment of Radio Free America program number 38, the Terror Connection Part 4, Realizing the Fourth Reich. And this particular installment, this particular section of RFA 38, will also be going into the archives as an addendum to Radio Free America program number 31, the destabilization of the Carter administration. And I have with me on the phone from Southern California, Farah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance. And once again, let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that the gods of technology smile upon us. Good evening, Farah. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good evening to you.
Welcome.
How are you?
Very good. Very good. Well, the technology gods are smiling on us this evening, and the phone hookup here is working very well. Now, last week, Farah, on the air, I read the circular letter, this four-page circular letter that you and your colleagues in the Iranian resistance have generated. Once again, this is entitled Crucial Information About 1979 Iranian Hostage Crisis Ignored by the Major News Media. We have read this. I read this into the record last week. We'll be going over the material again this evening. The basic thrust of this letter is that, in fact, the collaboration between the Islamic fundamentalist government of Iran and the national security establishment of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, this collaboration came to light as a result of the Iran-Contra scandal in the United States. It also, that collaboration has been alleged by many to have involved a deal between the Khomeini forces in Iran and the Reagan and Bush campaign to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the United States Embassy in November of 1979 until Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. The information developed by your colleagues, you and your colleagues in the Iranian resistance, is that in fact those incidents were relatively minor outgrowths, or those elements were relatively minor outgrowths of a much more broadly based and longer standing pattern of collaboration between the Islamic fundamentalist forces in Iran and our national security establishment. And I'd like to go into that in considerable detail this evening, and we have quite a bit of time left. I thought that an interesting jumping off point, Farah, would be to go back to the immediate post-World War I period and talk about the British role in setting up the first Shah of Iran. It's my understanding that the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was the second of the Shahs. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And in particular, the strategic role of the Shah and of Iran, as envisioned by the British, in containing the fledgling Bolshevik government of the fledgling the Bolshevik government of the fledgling Soviet Union.
That's correct.
What could you describe the process? Because most Americans have no idea about how the Shahs came to power, and this is history unknown to most Americans. Again, well, in the immediate post-World War I period.
Well, one of the issue that I would like to clarify here is that most of the studies that I have done is basically the hidden story about the hostage crisis and how the relationship between the loyalist at the intelligence community, loyalist to Bush, and the fundamentalist under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini came to exist. We have to realize that the Shah was an absolute monarch of Iran, and this I'm talking about Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, which after the World War II he came to power, and he was the CIA on-site manager since 1953 CIA coup that was engineered and brought him to power.
Right, and that was when Prime Minister Mossadegh was thrown out of power.
What we have to remember is that in 1950s, the former Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, he created a policy, and I would quote from his book, War and Peace, that he wrote in 1950. He says, quote, "The religions of the East are deeply rooted and have many precious values. Their spiritual belief cannot be reconciled with communist atheism and materialism. That creates a common bond between us, and our task is to find it and develop it."
Of course, John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State for the Eisenhower administrations at the same time as his brother, Alan Dulles, was Director of the CIA at the time when Mossadegh was overthrown.
That is very true. Now, one issue that is here when we talk about the alliance that was developed, between the George Bush loyalists at the CIA and the intelligence community has created quite a bit of questions. And particularly when it came to the whole issue of the Iranian hostage crisis, one basic question has never been answered. And that is that why were the hostages taken to begin with? And that is a central question to the whole area of so-called hostage crisis that has not been touched on. We'll get to that a little bit later on, of course.
Okay, now, just for the benefit of the audience, it was John Foster Dulles who conceived a policy. By the way, what is the name of the book in which he makes that statement?
War and Peace.
War and Peace.
That's correct.
He envisioned the religions of the East, in this case obviously involving Islam, as a bulwark against the atheism of communism or Bolshevism. If we have time for it, I don't want to direct the discussion past the point, because I have been told by people that, in fact, the very first Shah was installed by the British and envisioned by the British as a strategic bulwark against the Soviet Union, and it is the strategic use of Iran, whether the Shah's government or the Islamic forces, as a bulwark against the Soviet Union that underlies all of the discussions that we're going to be in, the discussion that we're going to be engaging in vis-a-vis the hostage crisis.
That's correct. Now, what we have to remember is this, that the cornerstone of American foreign policy was to confront communist atheism with the religious principles. Now, that is God versus non-believers.
Mm-hmm.
That was how the certain faction of the U.S. intelligence community, I call them network, became comrades in arms with the Khomeini's Islamic fundamentalists. The result of this alliance was that from January 1978, the Iranian populist revolution became infested with the fundamentalist movement, which eventually consumed the host. By February 3rd, 1978, while Khomeini still was in Iraq in exile, the network concluded that the code, that the Shia Islamic movement dominated by Ayatollah Khomeini is far better organized, enlightened, and able to resist communism than its detractor would lead us to believe. It is rooted in the Iranian people more than any Western ideology, including communism. Now, the hostage crisis from the outset was to persist until all of its objectives had been fulfilled. The Republicans safely inaugurated and Ayatollah Khomeini in full control of Iran, although history makes no secret of who benefited from those struggles. Most folks find it very difficult to picture these two odd lovebirds feathering in the same nest.
And namely, U.S. intelligence and these, in particular, that faction of it associated with Bush and Reagan and the Islamic fundamentalist
forces.
In Iran. Perhaps before we go into the hostage crisis and the various strategic considerations involved, let's go back to where you begin, Farah, in your letter, namely 1974, when Richard Helms, formerly Director of Central Intelligence, is U.S. Ambassador to Iran, and he learned that the Shah had cancer.
That's correct. Now, Richard Helms, in 1973, as we all know, during the Nixon administration, he was dismissed by Nixon, and he was sent to Iran as the American ambassador. And he was there between 1973 till 1976. During this time, he developed a very close relationship with the Shah. But his relationship with the Shah of Iran goes back to from mid-1930s, when Shah of Iran and Richard Helms, and one of the Shah's very close friends, and we should remember his name. His name is General Hossein Fardoust.
How is that spelled, Farah?
It's F-A-R-D-O-U-S-T. And Hossein is H-O-S-S-E-I-N. He was one of the Shah's very close friends from their childhood. And they went to school together in Switzerland. And in mid-1930s, Richard Helms was in the same school called La Rossi in Switzerland. And there are pictures of that, by the way.
So that the Shah and Richard Helms actually were old school chums in Switzerland.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that also, the same school was Hossein Fardoust. Now, the reason for that is, we should mention here, because it was Hossein Fardoust who was the head of a very top security intelligence organization in Iran that even Savak and many other ministries, they used to send their reports to him, and everything was filtered to him and passed to the Shah.
Now, the Savak was the secret police and intelligence service of the Shah, and
yes.
You're saying that they actually utilized an even more secret group of Iranian intelligence?
That's correct.
That was
that
headed
was
by
the oversight intelligence community inside the palace under Hossein Fardoust.
All right.
Hossein Fardoust was called by the U.S. ambassador to Iran after Richard Helms, whose name was William Sullivan, as Shah's eyes and ears. Now, the reason that I put emphasis on Hossein Fardoust, because Hossein Fardoust was the man closest to the Shah that provided the information of the Shah's cancer to Richard Helms. By 1975, Richard Helms knew of the Shah's cancer.
Okay, so once again, just to recap for our listeners, we have Helms, who should never be forgotten, was formerly director of the CIA. One never reaches a position of that importance in the CIA and is able, you never sever your connections with the agency. You know too much and you're too highly placed. He is the U.S.'s ambassador to the Shah. His association with the Shah and Hossein Fadoust goes all the way back to their school days in Switzerland in the 1930s. Fadoust, the head of a very important group within Iranian intelligence, which it actually superseded to a certain extent, if I understand you, the SAVAK, and it is that organization and Hossein Fadoust that provides the information to Richard Helms that the Shah has cancer.
That's correct. He was actually the chief of Imperial Inspectoral, that an ultra-secret intelligence within the palace itself. And he had the authority to enforce cooperation from every ministry and government agency in Iran, including SAVAK. Now, as being a gatekeeper, he was able to virtually filter any information that he got to the Shah and even influence what Shah was permitted to know and to see. Now, there was a man in at the American Embassy in Tehran who was the deputy director of the political section at the U.S. Embassy, who was also a CIA analyst, whose name is John D. Stample, and he was in Iran from 1975 to 1979.
Okay, now, how is his name spelled?
It's John D. Stample. It's S-T-E-M-P-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
He has written a book about Iran called Inside the Iranian Revolution. In his book, he describes Fadoust as follows. Quote, as someone close to the Shah, he's talking about Fadoust, would have been among the first to learn about monarch's serious illness and its effect on his firmness and judgment. This is describing Hossein Fadoust. Now, what we have talked about is that in 1975, obviously, Richard Helms learned the information about the Shah's cancer from Hossein Fadoust. By 1975, it was very clear that how Fadoust was playing a role as being a mole within the palace, as the closest man to the Shah. Again, John D. Stample characterizes Fadoust's importance to the network or the George Bush's loyalist among the intelligence community. He says, quote, it is hard to overestimate the value of having a mole in the inner console of the Shah, close quote. Now, once we learn this, then we know that there is Richard Helms, being a former CIA director, stationed in Iran. During his time, of course, a flow of arms sales to Iran was taking place, and he himself, I believe, was in May of 1976, he confirms his relationship to the Shah, and he says, in the secret communique that he sent to Chief Inspector General Herbert F. Props, it's P-R-O-P-P-S, he says, quote, I have a close and friendly relationship with the Shah and the senior government of Iran officials. And the Shah is accessible as well as to certain other designated members of the mission. Close quote.
Okay, now we should also interject at this point that Iran in general and the Shah in particular had long been, as we've touched on, cornerstones of American anti-communist, anti-Soviet policy in the Middle East. And the Nixon administration in particular, and Helms became ambassador to Iran in that administration, was very active, Henry Kissinger and et al., very active in arming the Shah, who was envisioned as sort of the flank element of NATO against Soviet military expansion.
That's correct. Now, as we have learned, based on the documentation and the research that I have done within the last 13 years, I did 11 years of research up to about 3 years ago, and I did start my formal investigation to the episode of the hostage crisis as a formal investigation almost about 2 years and 8 months ago. And during this investigation, I came up to learn some startling evidence and documentation of many compelling events and stories that up to now has not been known to public. In 1976, we have to also remember that it was during the Ford administration that George Bush became the director of the CIA. Exactly one day after the result of election was known to the public that Carter was going to be the next president of the United States, on November 4th, 1976, there is a document from Director of Central Intelligence, George Bush, sent to the chief of CIA station in Iran, and making inquiry about the Shah's state of health. And you have a question?
I just wanted to read very briefly this memo. We read it last week. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind now, this is, as Forrest said, this is November 4th, 1976. Jimmy Carter has just defeated Gerald Ford in the presidential race. George Bush is director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the following memo from George Bush reads, and this is in your note A,
right,
on the circular letter, quote, "Have there been any changes in the personality patterns of the Shah? What are their implications for political behavior? Identification of top military officers that most likely play key roles in any transference of power if the Shah were killed." And you also in note A have another memo from that same date which states, quote, "Not only do we need future reflection on what is behind the Shah's words and action, but also additional information and field analysis is needed as to how decisions are formed and who is influential in implementing them. It is particularly important to know what subjects are withheld from the Shah and the degree to which reports to him are doctored by his subordinates. To what extent do such practices warp his perspectives, isolate him, and peril his regime? They, people at the agency, do not have adequate information and field analysis regarding his succession to throne." In other words, knowing at this point, as the CIA does, that the Shah has cancer, there are concerns about who will succeed the Shah being a major element, a keystone of American anti-Soviet policy in the Middle East. Continuing with the memo from 11-4-76, "What are the mechanics? Who will be the leading actors? How will the Shah's pet projects, including the economic development program, be affected by his departure?" So at this point, George Bush, as director of the CIA, immediately after Jimmy Carter's election, is showing great interest on behalf of CIA in what the Shah, what his state of mind is, what his policies are, and who will succeed him.
That's correct. Now, we have to remember here that at this time, according to what record shows and what we know during the Carter administration had no knowledge of what was happening to the Shah, because the official version is that the Carter administration did not know of the Shah's cancer till very late in 1978. As a matter of fact, the degree to how his illness came to the point that became very severe and he had to be admitted to the United States up to October 1979, Carter did not know to what degree Shah was ill, and that was the basis that they admitted the Shah to the United States.
So, in other words, what you're saying, Farah, if I'm understanding you correctly, is that although the CIA and George Bush, through former CIA Director Helms, knew about the Shah's cancer, beginning with 74, well, Bush was not CIA director then, but that was known to the U.S. intelligence community as early as 74, but that Jimmy Carter, who conducted a house cleaning of many veteran CIA operatives, did not know about it till 78.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, what we have to also know that the Carter administration, under Stansfield Turner, that who became the director of CIA from the beginning of 1977, and we also should remember this, that late November 1976, when it was known that Carter is going to be the next president, George Bush made a visit to Plain Georgia asking George Bush, I mean asking Carter, to let him to stay on for another 6 months. And Carter did not agree. Now, we have to also here to bring to the attention of your listeners that during the Carter administration, he had three slogans that he campaigned on during his presidential campaign. These three, number one was that he emphasized the issue of the human rights on international level, and particularly in the Middle East. Second, he promised that he's going to do some sort of a house cleaning of the CIA, and especially since the events of the Salvador Allende's being toppled by the CIA under Richard Helms. And the third issue was that he wanted to contain the unlimited supplies of armament to the Middle East, and especially to Iran. If you remember the debate that he had with
Gerald Ford,
one of the issues that he put quite a bit of emphasis was that to really limit the arms shipment to Iran. And so these three issues was very important. Now, as long as that the Republicans were in office, and as long as they would have had the CIA and the intelligence community to control the situation in Iran in the events of the Shah's demise, they didn't have any problem. But the minute that it was known that the Republicans and Gerald Ford is not going to be in the White House, that's when the telex was sent. Under George Bush's directorship at the CIA, there is a very interesting name that we have heard about him during the Iran-Contra, was Theodore Shackley, who was the deputy director of the CIA, and he was designated to that post by by George Bush. And in the event, if Gerald Ford would have been the president, he was supposed to be the director of CIA.
So Shackley, you're saying, would have replaced Bush as CIA
director? That's correct. And Theodore Shackley became, during the George Bush's campaign, became George Bush's speechwriter. And we also know that Theodore Shackley had a very good relationship with quite a few other individuals that became known in the ISCO effort later on. One of them was Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple, and there were quite a few other people that they have known each other from Southeast Asia. And one of the people that were very close to Theodore Shackley was William Sullivan, who was in Laos and then later on became the ambassador to Philippines. And William Sullivan then comes as a man within the intelligence community soon after Carter becomes the president, and he becomes the American ambassador to Iran after Richard Helms.
So William Sullivan, U.S. ambassador to Iran at the time of the hostage crisis, was a long-standing associate of many of these CIA professionals who were fired by Jimmy Carter and Stansfield Turner when Carter conducted a house cleaning of the CIA.
Absolutely.
I would also note, too, that in the period when George Bush was director of the CIA, the operations of Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson in training and arming many of the world's most notorious terrorist groups, Gaddafi's terrorist cadre in Libya, elements of the Red Brigades in Italy, elements of the Japanese Red Army faction, the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Turkish Grey Wolves, some elements, not the IRA per se, but some of the elements of the IRA that have been involved in some of the more notorious incidents there. All of these were among the beneficiaries, also Carlos the Jackal. All of these were among the beneficiaries of the expertise, the arming and training of Turple and Wilson. When that operation came to light, the public was told that Turple and Wilson were rogue CIA agents, that they were acting on their own. In fact, as a number of former participants in and students of the intelligence community have documented, it is absolutely inconceivable that their operation was not being conducted as a deep cover U.S. intelligence operation, again, to arm and train many of the terrorists that we here in the United States were told we need to arm ourselves against and that we need greater security procedures at home to protect against. But that was initiated by George Bush's CIA and people like Theodore Shockley and Thomas Kleins, later involved in the Iran-Contra affair, were key elements in the Triple Wilson operation.
That's correct. But one part that I'm sure that you forgot to mention it is the role that Edwin Wilson played with Frank Turple, who is still a fugitive, training Omar Gaddafi's in Libya. And that's one of the reasons that Edwin Wilson is serving a 53-year jail sentence.
Right.
A federal penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that this is quite important to mention here, because we find later on, as we develop presentation, that what role Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson played in just about August of 1978, destroying one of the competitors to Khomeini, who was a Shiite Muslim leader in Lebanon, the leader of the ML organization, that who was taken in August 27, 1978 to Libya, and he was destroyed as one of the Khomeini's competitor to clean up the path for Khomeini's rise to power.
Now, what was that individual's name?
His name was Ayatollah Musa Saad, that he was an Iranian that originated was in Iraq, and then from Iraq he formed the organization Amal, and then he moved to Lebanon, and in August 27, 1978, he all of a sudden mysteriously disappeared. Mm. And when he supposedly went to Libya, and in Libya, based on the information that I was, got through interviewing some of the people within the intelligence community, that he was taken over there and he was killed.
Now, this is interesting. Now, how was his name spelled, Farah?
Musa Saad.
That would be M-O-U-S-S-A?
That's correct.
And then
S-A-D-R. S-A-D-R, Saad.
So he was an opponent of the Shah's, but a rival of Khomeini's.
That's
as a possible
successor. He was one of his competitors.
Right.
And he was much more moderate, and they didn't want to have somebody as moderate as he was, so they wanted to take him away. We talk about that a little bit later on. But one thing that, Dave, it's very important to get into here is the philosophy behind this alliance. Why they came together, and what was the reason for the George Bush's crowd and loyalists at the CIA and Ayatollah Khomeini's fundamentalists to form this alliance.
Right.
This private alliance was a logical outcome of certain conditions. One was the Shah's cancer, of which I call them their spook network, had exclusive knowledge, foreknowledge.
And which they were keeping from Jimmy Carter.
That's correct.
Okay.
The second was America's strategic interest, or at least they spook vast, incredibly profitable entrees, which required protection and continuity.
Okay.
Third item was the election of the Jimmy Carter, which took control of the situation officially out of their hands. The fourth was Carter's human rights policy, which influenced the Shah to permit token concession to suppress voices of the dissent in Iran.
The Shah, by the way, was a brutal tyrant.
Yes,
and,
particularly the Savak.
Right, the Savak were actively suppressing all dissent in Iran.
That's correct. And then this alarmed their spooks within the network. Finally, Carter's Halloween massacre, in which he fired George Bush, the designated Theodore Shockley, and some 820 of the covert operative within the CIA. That was the thing that really pissed them off. This combination of factors motivated these people to launch their own private plan for a transference of power. Now, you mentioned the reading of a secret communique, they were talking about the transference of power. That's where it comes. Mm-hmm. The transference of power within Iran, and for the demise of President Carter. For them, Iran's new power structure had to embody those many precious values that John Foster Dulles was talking about.
In other words, basically a religious-based, spiritualist, anti-Bolshevism.
That's correct.
Anti-communism.
Which it was deeply rooted in the Iranian society.
Mm-hmm. And this against the background, again, of Iran as a cornerstone of America's anti-communist policy in the Middle East.
That's correct.
Something also going back, as I understood, all the way back to World War I when the British installed the first shop.
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Now, these many precious values that they were so deeply rooted in the Iranian society, then we have got the Islamic fundamentalism, which it was the spiritual belief that could have not been reconciled with communist atheism. And they found it, and the task was to develop it. Now we have to figure out what was the goal and what was their objective. Their goal was to promote the new world order by accomplishing two objectives. One was to keep Iran strategically intact and communist free,
mm-hmm,
by installing Khomeini's fundamentalist in power and on full control. Two was install the favorite son, George Bush, in the White House. It didn't matter whether he was first the vice president, but the important thing was to get him to the White House. And as you know, from the second week of the Reagan to be in the White House, George Bush was in control of many of the committees, including the anti-terrorist and many others.
And in fact, the vice president's task force on combating terrorism,
that's correct,
was the genesis point for the U.S. national security apparatus, which later came to light as having been used by Oliver North in the various aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, and which has given rise to things going far beyond anything directly to do with terrorism, as I will talk about later on in this show, that not this evening, but including the martial law contingency plans that were drawn up.
That's correct. For this cause, 52 Americans were held captive for 444 days, and tens of thousands of Iranians were murdered by what President Reagan called Iranian moderates.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now,
by the way, Farah, if we have time this evening, something that you might want to discuss was that you yourself, as a member of the Iranian resistance, have lost many close friends to the brutal executions by the security forces of the Khomeini government. You might want to describe some of that if you feel like it, because many Americans are not aware of the punishment that has been meted out to opponents of Khomeini.
Well, one thing that I would like to mention here is this, that in 1983, a man named Vladimir Kosichkin, who was the top man of the KGB,
mm-hmm,
in Iran, he defected in 1982 to the British. In 1983, he provided a list, supposedly, of certain Soviet spies or pro KGB elements to the CIA. Mm-hmm. In the spirit of goodwill, CIA provided a special list to Ayatollah Khomeini's regime, whereby hundreds and hundreds of Iranians were executed. Now, Khomeini called this a message from Allah. Now, this is the great Satan that he was talking about during Carter administration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of Iranians within the opposition have been brutally murdered by Islamic fundamentalist regime, the professional terrorist and henchmen throughout the world, and the latest of them were the three of the Kurdish resistance leaders from the Kurdish Democratic Party, that they were in daylight in October of this year. They were machine gunned in a restaurant in Berlin.
October of 1992.
That's correct.
These were Kurdish-Iranian resistance people.
Right.
Okay.
And, of course, not all of them, but they have been killing all the opposition members. And also, since the Clinton has won the election and now he's in the White House, they, former Khomeini's aides, like Ibrahim Yazdi, Dr. Yazdi, that who was during the beginning of the Iranian Revolution, he was Khomeini's deputy prime minister, and later on he was the foreign minister of Iran. He was the one that was with Khomeini. He played a very important role during taking of the hostages, particularly the first one, and then subsequent to that was the November 4th. The first one is the February 14th, 1979, that hardly anybody talks about,
mm-hmm.
which is a fascinating story. And then why that even happened 2 weeks after Khomeini came to power, why would they attack the American embassy and taking American hostages, including the American ambassador? And then why this man was being provided intelligence briefing by the CIA, particularly George Cave, and with the knowledge at the time, Deputy Secretary of State Warren Christopher, and I think that one of the cables that you read from the information that you had in your position, which was a crucial information about the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis,
mm-hmm.
reflects that. And the role of George Cave in Iran, and he was providing all this intelligence up to 4 days before the hostages were taken on November 4th, 1979.
Let's jump back before we get to the first of the hostage crises. Let me just read a couple of paragraphs, for a reread, I should say, since I read it this whole circular letter last week. On page 2, paragraph 5, you and your colleagues have, in response to Carter's lack of, quote, cooperativeness, unquote, the pro-Bush covert team then fomented the Islamic Revolution and piggybacked it onto the existing popular revolt against the Shah. It should be remembered that the Islamic fundamentalist movement came to power in Iran as a result of a two-stage revolution, in this respect at least, somewhat similar to the Russian Revolution, in which there was a democratic anti-Tsarist revolution, and then came the Bolshevik Revolution of Lenin. There was initially an anti-Shah democratic revolution, which got rid of the Shah, which forced his abdication. Then Khomeini came to power after the Shah was already out.
That's correct.
Now, this is in paragraph 5. And then in paragraph 6, one of the most remarkable pieces of information that you and your colleagues have developed, Farah, by the end of April 1978, private citizens George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher were in Iran. A confidential minutes of U.S. Embassy country team meeting under direction of U.S. Ambassador William Sullivan, dated April 26, 1978, is noted. Quote, the ambassador commented on our distinguished visitors, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Margaret Thatcher, and commented that Tehran seems to be the site for an opposition party's Congress. Again, I want to emphasize for the benefit of the audience that I'm in no way casting aspersions on your research. You've shown me some of the documentation for some of the things that you have, Farah, all what I've seen so far all checks out, plus an awful lot of the information you're providing has been on the public record in one form or another, or dovetails with things that I've been discussing for years. I want to emphasize that there are things that I personally cannot vouch for, and this is not to cast aspersions on your research, but rather to encourage other journalists and researchers to work with you on this, because the importance of what you and your colleagues in the resistance have developed really could not be exaggerated, and in addition to obviously having the most profound implications for the Iranian people, these developments and these allegations also have the most profound implications for those of us here in the United States as well. And this is one of the most remarkable pieces of information, one of the most remarkable allegations in your letter.